For this reason, I set up a control group of people whose sanity and habitual veracity I could vouch for, and proceeded to expose them to conditions which allegedly would produce UFO contact. The instructions, of course, had come from an alleged UFO source which I had come across several times in my research. Since 1962, I have worked with over 100 of these human guinea pigs who were successful in mentally receiving what I believe to be messages from UFOs. The data collected through these telepathic receivers created a problem in evaluation. I had originally hoped to be able to extract material of a scientifically evidential nature from these experiments, but soon after the start of the experiment, I realized that rigorous analytical control was not possible. Telepathy itself is still proving extremely difficult to investigate scientifically, when the receiver and the sender both can be monitored exhaustively. And, needless to say, if we could put our hands on the UFO senders to test them, we would have our experiments end. Yet it was possible to produce an unending supply of data. So I simply chose to generate a great deal of data, figuring that it was a mistake to expect material of this nature to fit any preconceived notion that I might have had. After carrying on this experiment for over 13 years, I now feel that I can make the following statement. The information claimed to be received by numerous UFO contactees can be duplicated in a controlled situation. For example, in numerous instances, I have been able to produce the telepathic contact in people who have no previous knowledge of UFO literature. In each case, the message which they receive has correlated in its content to a very high degree with other UFO contactees' messages. The results of this experiment indicate to me that we should take a very close look at this UFO contactee information. It is my belief that within this information is the key to creating a much more direct contact with the elusive UFO phenomenon. When I work with Uri Geller, the results we achieve with telepathic experiments are remarkably good. My drawing Geller's response, Geller's drawing my response. Many professional magicians have stated that Geller is actually a very clever trickster with no special mental ability. It seems that few of them have applied the scientific method of repeated experiment to determine his ability. I found that, for my own edification, the most conclusive tests were those performed in a random fashion during the normal daily routine, completely unannounced. That is, Uri did not know that I was testing his telepathic ability as we carried on a normal conversation during the day. The result, for me, there is no doubt that Uri Geller is a first-class telepathic sender and receiver. Telepathy is not a difficult technique to learn. I am convinced that it is a basic form of communication that our civilization has forgotten due to lack of use. It is analogous to the ability to do one-arm push-ups. Anyone can do them, with enough practice and conditioning. Most of us can show evidence of a telepathic muscle, since we've usually had experiences of starting to talk about a subject simultaneously with a close acquaintance. Telepathic communication is very similar to radio communication. If you think of everyone having a radio transmitter and receiver in their brain, you have a close analogy. Our problem is to learn to tune this mental radio for clear transmission and reception. It is my theory that the UFO contactees are receiving, on often poorly tuned receivers, the powerful and accurately tuned signal of the UFO's transmitter. Learning to receive is very simple. It requires practice in making the mind a total blank. This is easier for some of us than others. One way to do this is to make a daily practice of sitting in a comfortable position and letting the conscious mind run down or become less active. Finally, short periods of consciousness with no thoughts can be achieved. This is the beginning to tuning the receiver, and is the condition necessary for the UFO contact experiment to succeed. Now, this is still far from perfect tuning, but it can be sufficient if, as in the case of the UFOs, the transmitter is very strong. It seems that language is no barrier to telepathic communication. For instance, a German sender may think, Messer, meaning knife, and the American receiver will get the impression of a knife. The general contact of that communication will have been achieved, though perhaps nuances and meaning are lost. I believe this to be the case in most UFO contact communications, and accounts for the seemingly common nature of the language. Once the subjects in my experiment were trained, it was necessary to attract the UFO transmitter. The most efficient way of doing this seemed to be a simple handoff. The trained receiver was exposed to a contactee for a brief period, not long enough to dilute the evidential quality of the data which the new receiver might be expected to produce. Since a study of this nature takes years to produce, and since most of the evidential quality is extracted slowly and cumulatively by the experimenter, it is difficult to prove to the casual observer the nature of the alleged contact. To most researchers, this evidence is simply not conclusive. Since I have observed over 100 people go through this process and have read millions of words of contactee literature, both published and unpublished, I believe that I am now in a position to select the highly correlative material from the masses of communications. Moreover, the material in the body of this book is selected by me to best represent the material received from the large number of contactees whose material I have studied. I have no way of vouching for 100% accuracy, however, I have tried to reduce my personal bias to a minimum by investigating as much material as I could find. The answers you find here are the result of a careful selection from literally millions of words of alleged UFO communication spanning over 20 years and involving contactees both silent and published, as well as my own experimentally fabricated contactees. I will make the following observations concerning the general nature of the alleged telepathic communications from UFOs. 1. People who have had face-to-face encounters with UFOnauts report telepathic communication more often than any other form. 2. Those who claim communication at a distance with a UFO source report that telepathic contact was used in an overwhelming majority of cases. 3. The same general message permeates over 90% of the millions of words received by thousands of people around the world. 4. I have been able to experimentally fabricate contactees who, with no prior background in UFO literature, produced the general UFO doctrine in detail. 5. Most of my fabricated contactees who have seen a UFO have done so shortly after becoming contactees. 6. There are over 100 contactees which have been fabricated in my group. Their backgrounds represent a general sampling of our society with educational levels ranging from grade school to postdoctoral. 7. Over 90% of these fabricated contactees experienced identical physical symptoms during the time of the contact. 8. A single message would sometimes be delivered through a dozen contactees, apart through each one. Though the contactees were of different backgrounds and educational levels, the message would be uniform, of coherent continuity, and largely free from normal errors and hesitations of speech. 9. Two of my fabricated contactees were given only one day of training before returning to their home some 600 miles away. Their progress was monitored by mail, and the result was still the same. 10. I have found that some people can achieve the contact phenomenon simply by being hypnotized. No preparation or training is necessary for this type of contact. The content of messages received is the same as the great majority of all other contacts. 11. It is not necessary for the fabricated contactees to believe in UFOs or the reality of the contact phenomena to produce the communications. One of my best hypnotic contactees has never believed, and still refuses to countenance, any part of the phenomenon, although her communications have in all cases been excellent and have matched in exact detail the bulk of other contactee material. 12. Several of the contactees, particularly those with extensive training in the physical sciences, maintained a highly objective and somewhat skeptical attitude throughout the experiment and still produced excellent communications, precisely analogous to the bulk of material received. The process of receiving contact is so simple that it is difficult to adequately describe it. Some people seem to have a terrific natural ability to receive this contact, and some almost none. To receive the contact, it is only necessary that a person learn to clear his mind by any process that seems to work, and then await the contact. I realize that this sounds much too simplistic to yield results. Yet this is the method, If you can call such a simple concept a method, which has produced in my own experimental work many contactees who have produced many thousands of words of standard contactee doctrine. Chapter 3, Reality, etc. In our culture there seems to be very little communication between science and religion, and yet the practitioners of both disciplines claim that their studies are fundamental to an understanding of basic truth. What emerges from the UFO communications is the attitude that there is a single valid approach to the complete understanding of the universe, and that this approach blends what we presently consider to be two separate disciplines and philosophies. My personal bias, at least during the initial stages of my investigation, was wholly on the side of the scientific disciplines. As the investigation continued, however, I kept finding what seems to be a religious or spiritual factor in the contact phenomena. My determined bias towards open-minded and impartial observation led me finally to acknowledge this factor as a genuine part of ufology. At present, I no longer regard this factor as separate from a scientific understanding of the phenomena. The seemingly religious content of the communications is seen as such because of our own cultural conditioning. We interpret these messages as religious. It is my belief that the foundation of a much more nearly absolute and true philosophy of natural phenomena is being made available through the UFO contacts. At present, our languages are inadequate to communicate anything but the first step in the evolution of our thinking. It will be necessary for us to make this first step, in order to begin to understand how to make the second. Paranormal phenomena. Several years ago, I had the opportunity to converse with some ghosts that materialized into our physical world and then vanished after our conversation. To many psychical researchers, this phenomenon, known as materialization due to ectoplasmic emission from a medium, is an established and accepted occurrence. It is my belief that anyone following the rules and conditions laid down for this type of contact can achieve it, assuming that he is in the presence of a suitable materialization medium, an individual capable of producing ectoplasmic emissions. The most evidential of the ghosts which I saw and talked to was a tall, ghostly individual who grew solid before my eyes, carried on a conversation with me, and then to prove his ability to manifest in the physical world, slapped me and my companion, Carla, solidly on the arms. Then he slowly walked through us, while we watched closely. Thus in the space of a few seconds, he displayed both the properties of a perfectly solid substance and those of total absence of solidity. Psychic researchers have for many years reported and photographed these ghostly materializations, but because of their inability to produce the phenomena at the demand of skeptical observers, little general interest has been developed in this research. As we unravel more of the UFO mystery, we will discover the reason why the skeptical or prove it to me approach is quite often the defeating factor in paranormal investigations. I also noticed this same factor in evidence as I recently observed several hundred seemingly miraculous bare-handed surgical operations in the Philippines. I saw native psychic surgeons seemingly plunging their hands directly into the patient's unanesthetized bodies, pulling out all sorts of bloody parts while the patients remained perfectly conscious, watching the process and feeling no pain. The patients displayed no wounds or scars after the operation was completed. Here again the evidential quality of the operation witnessed was very dependent upon the attitude of the witness. It has been aptly stated that, with paranormal phenomena, believing is seeing. There are many observers who attend demonstrations of paranormal phenomena and who conclude that what they have seen was all trickery. I've had a lot of experience in witnessing these demonstrations, have seen several hundred authentic ghosts materialize, have watched much psychic surgery and had minor operations performed on myself, and in every case I have noted a common factor. If skeptical observers were present, the phenomena either didn't occur at all, or their quality was so poor that trickery would naturally be suspected. Now the skeptical observer doesn't like this facet of the phenomena at all and uses it as evidence of the fakery. His problem is that he doesn't understand why he, as a skeptic, can't be given evidential and inalienable proof of the reality of the phenomena. he absolutely cannot accept the necessity under the circumstance of his skepticism of taking the word of some believer, whom he usually considers deluded. The reason that this lack of proof must accompany skepticism will become evident as we further explore the UFO communications. My own stance is a balanced one, I hope, that of the believer who is skeptical of tricksters among the real practitioners. There are many fraudulent mediums and many quack psychic surgeons. I have seen both practicing their trades and am aware of their methods. Yet their existence does nothing to compromise the reality of the paranormal phenomena generated by the real mediums and psychic surgeons. A pertinent question when considering psychic demonstrations is, how does the paranormal event happen? The answer may well lie in the area of occult theory, which is concerned with the existence of various planes. The theosophists say that there are 14 mental planes associated with this planet. After death, they say, an individual finds himself at one of these 14 levels of existence, the level being dependent on the spiritual nature or development of the person at the time of his death. The cliché that covers this theory is a heavenly birds of a feather flock together. When a ghost materializes into our reality, it is from one of these 14 levels that he usually comes for his earthly visit. In general, it is theorized that a planet is a sort of spiritual distillery, with reincarnation taking place into the physical world until the individual is sufficiently developed in the spiritual sense that he can reach the higher states of existence, and is no longer in need of this planet's developmental lessons. Most of this theory was developed as a result of reported contact and communication with the inhabitants of these supposedly separate realities. The most satisfactory term I have come across for these different levels of reality is the word, density. I have come to believe that these densities interpenetrate with our physical space and mutually coexist, though with very little awareness of each other. A simple analogy, to which I've referred before, is to consider the actors in two different TV plays, both receivable on the same set, but each play being exclusive of the other. This seems to be what we experience in our daily lives, one channel or density of existence, being totally unaware of the myriad entities occupying other densities of our physical space. The point of all this is that our density or reality is not ultimate or singular, it is in fact our reality only at the present. Many of the UFO reports display ample evidence that the object sighted has its origin in one of these other realities or densities, just as do the materialized ghosts. I would like to emphasize that this does not in any way imply their unreality, rather, it displaces the UFO's reality from ours. I'm saying the equivalent of Channel 4 on the TV is equivalent to but displaced from Channel 3 on the same TV. If you were told to build a scale model of any atom using something the size of a pea for the nucleus, it would be necessary to have an area the size of a football stadium to contain even the innermost orbital electrons. If the pea were placed at the center of the 50-yard line, a small cotton ball on the uppermost seat in the stands could represent an electron of the atom. There is very little actual matter in physical matter. When you look at the stars in the night sky, you probably see something quite similar to what you would see if you could stand on the nucleus of any atom of solid material and look outward toward our environment. To demonstrate an electron to you, a physicist will probably show you a curved trace of one on a photographic plate. What he probably does not tell you is that this is second-hand evidence. The electron itself has never been seen, only its effect on a dense medium can be recorded. It is possible, of course, to make accurate mathematical calculations about what we call an electron. For such work we must know some data on magnetic field strength, electron charge and velocity. But since a magnetic field is caused by moving charges, which in turn are empirically observed phenomena, we find that the entire mathematical camouflage obscures the fact that all we really know is that charged particles have effects on each other. We still don't know what charged particles are, or why they create an action at a distance effect. Senior scientists would be the first to agree that there is no such thing as an absolute scientific explanation of anything. Science is, rather, a method or tool of prediction, relating one or more observations to each other. In physics, This is usually done through the language of mathematics. Our scientific learning is a learning by observation and analysis of this observation. In the sense of penetrating the fundamental essences of things, we really do not understand anything at all. A magnetic field is nothing but a mathematical method of expressing the relative motion between electrical fields. Electrical fields are complex mathematical interpretations of a totally empirical observation stated as Coulomb's law. In other words, our forest of scientific knowledge and explanations is made up of trees about which we understand nothing except their effect, their existence. Baba Ram Dass, formerly Dr. Richard Alpert of the Department of Psychology at Harvard University, met Sai Baba in India and was given a small medallion by that guru. Sai Baba held out his hand, a glow appeared in his palm, and the glow slowly solidified into the medallion. Dr. Alpert was amazed and commented to one of Sai Baba's associates on this miracle of creation. "Oh, don't be silly, he didn't create that," replied the devotee. "He has a whole warehouse full of those things. He just transported it here mentally." Sai Baba's own attitude towards this sort of thing is that all is illusion, or Maya. This would seem to be a very accurate analysis of our physical world, which is most often apparent to mystics and atomic physicists. For an example of the mystical approach to our illusion, here is OSP explaining about all the heavenly bodies which we cannot see, because they are outside of our illusion. "When a planet hath attained to so great age, she no longer giveth forth light or heat to radiate upon herself, she cannot be seen in the heavens. Of which kinds of planets there are millions in the Aetherian firmament. Some of these move slower than any of the planets man can see. Some of these at times eclipse the sun, and are taken for sunspots, although, perhaps, not a million miles from the Earth." One to a person unfamiliar with the inner workings of modern science, it may seem that modern man has his environment nicely under control and totally figured out. Nothing could be farther from the truth. The leaders of science who are researching the frontiers of modern theory argue among themselves, with their followers dissenting in droves behind them. As soon as a theory begins to receive wide acceptance as being a valid representation of physical laws, someone finds a discrepancy, and the theory has to be either modified or abandoned entirely. Perhaps the most well-known example of this is Newton's F equals ma. This attained the status of a physical law before being found to be in error. It is not that this equation has not proven extremely useful. We have used it to design everything from a moon rocket to the television picture tube. But its accuracy fails when applied to atomic particle accelerators like the cyclotron. To make accurate predictions of particle trajectories, it is necessary to make the relativistic correction formulated by Einstein. It is interesting to note that the reason for this correction is based on the fact that the speed of light is totally independent of the speed of its source. If Newton had penetrated more deeply into the laws of motion, he might have made this relativistic correction himself, and then stated that the velocity correction would always be of no consequence, since the velocity of light was so much greater than any speed attainable by man. This was very true in Newton's day, but is definitely not the case now. We still tend to think of the velocity of light as a fantastic and unattainable speed, but with the advent of spaceflight, a new order of velocities has arrived. We have to change our thinking from our normal terrestrial concepts of velocities. Instead of thinking of the speed of light in terms of miles per second, think of it in terms of Earth diameters per second. The almost unimaginable 186,000 miles per second becomes an entirely thinkable 23 Earth diameters per second. Or we could think of the speed of light in terms of our solar system's diameter and say that light would speed at about 2 diameters per day. Einstein's assertion that everything is relative is so apparent that it has become a cliché of our culture. Let us continue being relativistic in considering the size of natural phenomena by considering the size of our galaxy. If you look up at the sky on a clear night, nearly all of the visible stars are in our own galaxy. Each of these stars is a sun like our own. a calculation of the ratio of the number of suns in our galaxy to the number of people on planet Earth discovers that there are 62 suns for each living person on Earth today. Earth's population is close to 4 billion, and there are 250 billion stars in the Milky Way. It takes light over 4 years to get from Earth to even the nearest of these stars. To reach the most distant star in our own galaxy would take light 100,000 years. These calculations are made using the assumption that light has a speed. This may be an erroneous assumption in the light of modern theory, but its apparent speed is a useful measuring tool, so we use it anyway. So we have a creation in which we find ourselves which is so big that at a speed of 23 Earth diameters a second we must travel 100,000 years to cross our immediate backyard. That is a big backyard, and it would seem ample for even the most ambitious of celestial architects, but in truth this entire system of 250 billion stars is just one grain of sand on a very big beach. There are uncounted trillions of galaxies like ours, each with its own 250 billion stars, spread throughout what seems to be infinite space. When you think of the mind-boggling expanse of our creation, and the infantile state of our knowledge in relation to it, you begin to see the necessity for considering the strong probability that our present scientific approach to investigating these expanses is as primitive as the dugout canoe is in relation to the whole state of the art of earthbound transport. The most perplexing problem of science has always been finding a satisfactory explanation of what is called action at a distance. In other words, everyone knows that if you drop something it will fall, but no one knows precisely why. Many people know that electric charges push or pull on each other even if separated in a vacuum, but again no one knows why. Although the phenomena are quite different, the equations which describe the force of interaction are quite similar. For gravitation, F equals gmm/r2 for electrostatic interaction. F equals kqq/r2 The attractive force between our planet and our sun is described by the gravitational equation. The attractive force between orbiting electrons and the atomic nucleus is described by the electrostatic interaction equation. Now each of these equations was determined experimentally. They are not apparently related in any way, and yet they both describe a situation in which attractive force falls off with the square of the distance of separation. A mathematical representation of an action at a distance effect is called a field, such as a gravitational or electric field. It was Albert Einstein's foremost help to find a single relation which would express the effect of both electric and gravitational phenomena, in fact, a theory which would unify the whole of physics, a unified field theory. Einstein believed that this was a creation of total order and that all physical phenomena were evolved from a single source. Over the years Einstein and other mathematical physicists published many unified field theories, none of them successful. A famous one, put forth by Kaluza, recast the mathematics of relativity in a space of 5 dimensions instead of the customary 4. Kaluza hoped that unification of gravitation and electromagnetism would follow by a suitable interpretation of the 5th dimension. Einstein took up Kaluza's work, but once more no new physical understanding appeared. The most celebrated unified field theory, called the generalized theory of gravitation, was published by Einstein in 1945, and independently by Schrödinger at about the same time. By then Schrödinger was disillusioned by quantum mechanics, which he himself had helped to create. For some years both these eminent men believed that the new theory would solve the problems which they thought still beset fundamental physics. The mathematics of the theory is very complicated, and it is necessary to use approximate methods. With these it was shown that the theory failed to satisfy the basic requirement that its field equations must determine the motion of electric charges present. This was enough to convince Schrödinger that the theory was useless. Einstein was not prepared to accept the approximate results. He maintained that the theory could be judged only if certain exact solutions of the generalized field equations were found. These exact solutions, he believed, would represent matter by pure field. This was the position he took up until his death. To this unified field theory, describing matter as pure field, has been accomplished now. It seems that the entire situation was analogous to the solution of a ponderously complex Chinese puzzle. If you can find the right key turns among so many wrong ones, the puzzle easily falls apart. Dewey B. Larson found the solution to this problem, and the puzzle not only fell apart, but revealed an elegantly adequate unified field theory rich in practical results. And, like a good Chinese puzzle, the solution was not complex, just unexpected.